were sidetracked with a wonderful, interesting, more than a story, but all your experiences in Washington. But let's get back to France. You mentioned you bought a car. What kind of car was it?
It was a Deux-Chevaux.
And you translate that for us, please?
It means 2 horsepower.
Right. And what kind was it? Who made it?
It was made by Citroën.
Right. You forgot to tell something about it because it's a historical thing.
It was a historical little car.
Right.
It was a wonderful little car. I mean, we traveled quite a bit in it. It was had a corrugated body, sort of ruffled corrugated body, and a canvas roof that rolled all the way down and up the back so that you could take the roof down and make a convertible out of it. The seats would come out, so if you wanted to have a picnic, you could just flip 4 levers and take the seats out and sit on them on the ground. So it was really very, very, very convenient little car. The only problem that we had with it was that the windows leaked, the windshield leaked, so that when we got caught in a rainstorm, the car inside would be almost as wet as the car outside.
Are they still making them?
I think they stopped now. They were making them in Spain for a long time, and they continued to make them in Spain after they stopped making them in France, but I don't think they made them in Spain. Didn't have safety glass, so you couldn't bring it back to the United States.
Oh, that was my next question. Okay, so you sold it in France.
Sold it in France, right. Well, it's interesting. Part of that story was how did I get the car? It was very hard to get cars in France, but you could buy them for dollars. The car cost, as I recall, something like $950, right, at the time, and then we were able to sell it because we could sell it to a Frenchman for francs, right, so they could buy our car, and that's how, I mean, that was a very easy kinds of transactions. So they paid us after 6 months. They paid us approximately what we had paid for the car.
We talked quite extensively about your time in Paris, and I'm sure you remember what you told us. Is there anything that you can think of that we need to know?
I think we covered.
I think
pretty thoroughly.
Okay. Now, what did you do next? You came back to the U.S. Where'd you go?
I started my first teaching job at the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, and I was there at the time. People taught 4 courses, I think, 3 courses, and I taught an extra course at night because professors weren't very well paid in those days, and so I made some extra money by teaching at night, and worked on my thesis. I had collected all the data while I was in France, and now I had to write it. So I spent every evening during the day working and teaching and working on my thesis to the extent that I could, and then in the evening I worked on my thesis, grinding out numbers on a hand calculator because we didn't have computers in those days. So you had to do, it's really almost history, you had to do things by a hand calculator. It was electric, but you had to punch in all the numbers and you had to do all these operations. It would take hours. I mean, what we can now do on a computer in a few seconds, certainly minutes, would take me 6 or 8 hours to do by hand, punching all the numbers and making sure. So it was really a lot of grinding out work that went on.
What was the date that UNIVAC was in?
Well, that was started. UNIVAC was there.
Yes.
There was UNIVAC had been developed during the war as a wartime project at the University of Pennsylvania.
Right.
Right. The first computer was actually called ENIAC. And that was up and running, but it wasn't being used very much except as an experimental thing. First computer that I saw that people actually used was when I came here, and in the basement of our building, Herb Simon who was very up on the idea of computers and had spent some time at Rand and was familiar with the idea, had gotten the idea of having a computer in the school, that is for Carnegie Mellon. And most of the people didn't use it, but we began to use it, and it was in the basement of GSIA when I got here. It had just come in. It was an old IBM 650 with vacuum tubes because the transistor computers had not yet been transistorized. I don't think the transistor had probably been invented at that time.
Now, I can look in your CV what year that was, but tell us.
That was 1957.
And he had it here then?
We had it here then, right. And we brought, I think that year, we brought to the university Alan Perlis, who developed the first algebraic languages. Up to that time, programming the computer was a much more difficult task. You had to write down every statement that you wanted it to do, and you couldn't write down algebraic statements as such. Alan Perlis taught the computer how to do how to read algebraic statements, so that was a tremendous boost to the use of computers. Anyway, the computer was here, and so I, we're getting ahead of the story, but anyway, I finished my thesis by doing some of the calculations on the computer.
Here?
Okay. After I came here.
Okay, now, you were at the University of Pennsylvania, how long?
That was 1 year, 56, 57.
56.
I didn't like it. I didn't find the atmosphere very stimulating. I didn't like the university. I mean, I wasn't terribly unhappy, but I didn't find it a very stimulating atmosphere or very conducive to research. And I had took the advice of one of my former professors, who said, if you're unhappy where you are, leave quickly, because otherwise it'll probably weigh on you, and you'll spend too much time thinking about the reasons why you're unhappy, so you won't do much, or you won't do the best work. So I decided at that point to look for a job. And usually in the academic profession, one doesn't go looking for a job. People come looking for you. But I didn't have that option, so I went looking for a job, and I wrote letters to places that I thought I would, where I thought I would be happier, and I ended up being hired here. And I was hired here mainly because the Carnegie Tech, as it was then called, Carnegie Tech, was the site of something called the Indian Steel Training Program. The Ford Foundation had put up a lot of money to train Indian engineers in to produce steel, and that was in 1957. And we were one of the sites where they were going to do that training, and they came here, and they needed some economists to teach them a little bit about economics as well as about engineering. And so there was an opening here to hire an economist, and I was one of the people who was hired.
And I'm assuming Indians from India, Indians.
No, okay. Indians from India, okay. Right. Right.
And they had English, so
They spoke English. But it was a tremendous event. I mean, they regarded, this was early in the post-war development period, and they regarded this program as an enormous achievement for India to bring back these trained Indians who would then develop the Indian steel industry. Anyway, we were part of that consortium along with, I think, some other engineering schools, MIT and others, to train the Indian engineers. And that's how I got to Carnegie.
I see. So how was this funded, this training program?
I think largely by the Ford Foundation.
I see.
Maybe
by
the U.S. government, perhaps by the Indian government,
okay,
too.
And did your salary come from
that? No, I had nothing to do with that program.
I see.
Other people who were here taught in that program, and
there was an opening vacancy
for to expand the program here.
So your salary came from
the university.
University.
Yes.
Has that been consistently so?
No, somewhere along the line, somewhere by 1960s, I was doing enough research, and I began to apply to the National Science Foundation to support the research. And the National Science Foundation supported either part or all of most of my salary, but certainly part of my salary, through the next 8 or 10 years. I don't remember exactly when. And by that time, they had given me a chair at the university, which was funded through the endowment, a separate endowment. And then later, there were other people who financed what I was doing here. So I've been a net supplier of funds to the university rather than a net drawer of funds on the university through most of my career.
Okay.
And of course, I haven't been here all the time. I've visited at other universities. But when I've been here, most often I have either contributed part of my salary by raising money on the outside, or contributed more than my salary, helping to support some of the younger people here. Through the center, for example, has been a fundraising. Part of its function is to raise funds, and so I run something called the Center for the Study of Public Policy, which started a program here and raised the money to support the program and supported some of the other faculty and a lot of the graduate students who worked in that center and who've gone off now to other universities.
Let's go backtrack a little bit. You came here. You are still working on your PhD with the computer.
I had finished everything. I had gone back to California in the summer of 1957 and defended my thesis. And one of my thesis committee happened to meet a man who has become since very prominent, Alan Entoven, who is the person who was the leader in the healthcare managed care system and the so-called Jackson Hole group. Well, Alan Entoven was a young person at RAND at that time, and one of my faculty at the RAND Corporation at that time, and one of my thesis members was very enthusiastic about my thesis and what I had been able to do with all these calculations that I had done, and was very excited about it. And he showed it to Alan Entover, and Alan Entover read it and said, well, he has a problem with serial correlation, which at the time I'd not heard about. So he convinced the thesis member, Alchin, that this was a problem. And so I did my defense, and I was passed on it, but I had to make some adjustments for serial correlation. And of course, since I didn't know anything about serial correlation, I had to learn about serial correlation. But that's the business I'm in, is the business of learning. And so I learned about serial correlation and made some adjustments to correct it. And it didn't change things very much, but anyway, it held me up for about 6 months while I worked on that. When I first came here, what I did was learn about serial correlation, program a computer to recalculate all of these things which I had laboriously done by hand.
Oh,
I now had to recalculate all of them and correct them, and I did that.
And you were awarded the PhD?
Yes,
by
in 1958, by the University of California,
right,
okay. Los Angeles.
And have you had other contacts with Enthoven over the years?
I know him, but he's worked in an area that I'm not very interested in, healthcare. I mean, everybody's interested in healthcare at the moment, but as a consumer, I had never worked on it, doing research in it. And so I know him, but I've not had a lot of contact with him.
Okay. Where did you live when you came to Pittsburgh?
I lived, I came here one weekend and rented a house. My wife, and at that time we had one child, had gone to California for the summer. And I finished up the work on my thesis, and since that was laborious and time-consuming, and I wasn't going to be around very much anyway, my wife went out to visit her mother and took our baby with her. In fact, I think, as I recall, I drove her out and then came back and spent the summer teaching summer school and working on my thesis so that I could be prepared to defend it. And the reason there was such a rush was partly because I wanted to have it done when I started here. I didn't succeed in doing that. And my thesis supervisor, Brunner, was going to Switzerland for the year, so I wanted to get it done before he went to Switzerland. So I worked very hard that summer to finish writing everything and calculating everything and writing it, and then went out to California in August and defended it. And as I said, I had this additional work to do, but there was no more defense. Once I did it, I would submit it to Alchin, Professor Alchin, who had raised these issues, and if he was satisfied, then everything would be finished.
You still didn't tell me where you were living.
Oh, I lived in Penn Hills.
Okay.
I came here and rented a house in Penn Hills.
Okay. And how long did you live there?
I lived in that house for a year, and the next year we bought a house, also in Penn Hills, farther out we bought a house, and lived there until 1966. But we had, I always liked the city, and I'd grown up in the city, in Boston. I'd grown up in the city, in a neighborhood in the city, and I liked the city. And we spent a year at the University of Chicago. And that year we lived right in the city, within walking distance of the University of Chicago. And my wife got to like that a lot. So when we came home, we decided to buy a house in the city. And that was in 1965. At that time, houses in Squirrel Hill didn't turn over very rapidly, and there were practically no signs. I mean, you had to get it by word of mouth. We found a house by word of mouth and bought it, and we had to wait a year. The people who were selling it were building a new house, so we bought the house and waited a year, and at the end of the year, we moved in. In fact, there's an amusing story. We were trying to sell our house, and we hoped to make the thing so that we would close on the house here in Squirrel Hill in September, at the end of August, and we hoped to sell our house and close on it about the same time. But the people who bought our house wanted to move in June. And so the day, I had received an invitation to spend the summer in Hawaii, and I had written a letter saying I didn't want to go. I mean, because we still had our house to sell. About 2 days later, we sold our house, so I sent a cable to the person and said, and these people wanted to be out in June, so we sold We sold the house, we moved out, we put our furniture in storage, and we all spent the summer in Hawaii, where I taught summer school for, I think, the second and only time in my career.
At the University of Hawaii. Was that a good experience?
It was lovely. We had three children at that point. They learned to swim in Hawaii, and they went to the beach every day, and they had a wonderful time. And we had a very nice summer.
Now, you mentioned you have three children at the time. We only know about Bruce so far.
Bruce,
you
right.
better tell us about
well,
the other two.
Well, Eric was born in 1958. In fact, he was the reason why we bought our house, because with Eric coming, the small house that we had rented from someone who worked for one of the advertising agency here, and he had gone to Turkey to help them with design, so he was gone for the year. We had to get out of his house anyway, and Eric was coming along, so we bought a new house, and bought a house out in Penn Hills. And so he was born in 58, and about a year later, we have a daughter, Beth, who was born in 1959, and so that was all. That's the end of that story.
That's the end of that story. Okay. So your wife was very busy. She wasn't.
She had three children under five.
Right? Okay.
So that I don't have to tell you that she was busy.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And she began to do some other things at that point, in order to maintain a little bit of sanity. And she began to weave. She was a handloom weaver. She had taken handloom weaving while I was writing, doing my PhD work. She did that at night. She worked during the day, and she was learning to be a handloom weaver in the evening. And so came home one day, and she said, "Don't take off your coat. We're going to look at a loom."
Oh,
and,
my.
And we went out, and we bought her first handloom. And so that gave her some a little bit of creative activity. She also developed into an extraordinarily good cook. And so that was another creative outlet for her. We had a lot of dinners, and she used a lot of her energy and creativity to do that. And usually I tried to work at home one day after the children started, I think two of the children were in school. I started to work at home one day, and that gave her a chance to be out a little bit more. But she was busy in those days.
I bet. So the house that you bought in Squirrel Hill is your current house?
It's the current house. We've been there since 1967.
Okay. Let me stop for one second. In Penn Hills, did you find any anti-Semitism?
No, nothing striking. I mean, there probably was some, but nothing very striking. I mean, we had friends there in the neighborhood, and we had people there in the neighborhood that we didn't have very much to do with, but I never had any real sense that that was a problem.
In your various academic positions, appointments, have you encountered?
No, the academic profession now is so full of Jewish professors that it'd be very difficult. It was certainly true.
That's
it'd be very difficult to do. It was certainly true 50 or 60 years ago that there were quotas on the number of Jewish professors. I think UCLA, where I went to school, probably had that kind of quota. Harvard had that kind of quota, and it's famous for not being willing to appoint Paul Samuelson, who was probably the most famous economist of his era. They wouldn't appoint him at Harvard. He went to MIT and built a very strong department there. UCLA also didn't have Jewish professors at the time. But all that disappeared in the post-war. I mean, there were so many Jewish PhDs in physics, mathematics, economics, that it would have been very difficult to have a good department without a good college, a good university. I mean, the number of Jewish PhDs in the sciences and in economics were very strong. If you think about some of the Nobel laureates in economics, I mean, Samuelson, Friedman, Solow, Arrow, I mean, there's a host of them, Kuznets, I mean, and many others, including this year Bob Fogel. I mean, there's just a whole lot of them. They're not all Jewish, but I mean, there's certainly a heavy representation of Jewish professors. So if you wanted to have a good economics department in the 50s or 60s, I mean, it was very difficult to maintain those restrictions, and they broke down. As the whole society was, they were breaking down in the society. When I remember that, for example, when Jews went to the Harvard Business School, they didn't go through the placement office. They had to find their own jobs. I mean, that all disappeared in the 50s or 60s.
Let me get tangential just for a second. In the morning paper, there is a story about the GI Bill and how it helped so many people. Do you think that might have been an influence?
Well, that helped. That helped. But I would say that what it helped to educate a lot of people, yeah, who probably would not have gone on that far. But in getting PhDs, most of that market is paid for. That
right.
Is,
but the initial.
But getting the original right. Education. Well, it certainly helped a lot of people to move up and get educated. But I would say that what made, what broke down the barriers of discrimination was competition. I mean, it became important to have people who were good at what they did, and if they were of some different kind of cult. I mean, you find, if you look at an American university today, you see that there are people who are East Indians, Chinese, mm-hmm. All kinds of people are teaching here. The reason is because we have the world's best universities and most competitive universities. As being a scholar in an American university is very much like running your own little business. I mean, you're in business for yourself. I mean, it's your ideas. You develop them. You try to fund them. Sometimes the university helps you. But you're competing with other people and cooperating, but also competing with other people who are trying to do the same things that you are. You're trying to do them better and faster and get your thing published first. So it's a very competitive business, and that's what brings out the best in people. It's also a very collaborative business in the sense that I may be competing with somebody at another place today on over some research program, but I may be collaborating with him tomorrow because we decide that we both can bring something to the problem that would be unique to that problem. So in that sense, we're all friends. We criticize each other harshly, and we compete fiercely, but we also cooperate so we have the best of what is a good competitive system. And it was competition that I think more than anything else, competition to be a great university, to be good, to get funding. After all, a good professor brings in his own funding because his work is recognized and people want to support it.
You've talked about your colleague, Dr. Simon,
yes.
Nobel Prize
yes.
winner. Would you like to tell us something about him and your relationship with him?
Well, he worked in areas very different from mine and at some point moved off and became much more interested in computers and psychology and eventually moved to the psychology department here.
Oh, I didn't know.
So that he still has a nominal appointment in our school, and has a nominal appointment in economics, and he comes to some of our faculty meetings and participates often in the promotion and process within the school. But we don't have a lot of intellectual contact. I mean, we're friendly and to some extent sociable, but we don't have a lot of intellectual contact.
Now, tell me if I'm correct. He did win the prize
for economics.
He won the prize
in economics. Yes, in economics. Yes, there is no... The only social science in which there's a Nobel Prize is in economics. And even that is... the original Nobel Prizes were funded by the will of Alfred Nobel. But I think on the occasion of the 50th, perhaps, anniversary of the Nobel Prizes, or the 70th anniversary of the Nobel Prizes, the Bank of Sweden, the Central Bank of Sweden, funded a prize which is called the Nobel Prize in economics, but it's not the same funding as the prize in physics, chemistry. There's none in mathematics. There's physics, chemistry, medicine, and biology are together. Peace and
the arts,
and
literature.
And literature, right. Right. And then they created one in economics. Beginning sometime in the 1960s.
That's interesting. Does the prize money come from a separate?
Comes
from
a separate
bank?
Endowment. It's
I
equal
see.
To the prizes in the other endowments, and I guess it's administered with the other endowments. But it's the money came from the 300. Oh, that's what was did it. It was the 300th anniversary of the Bank of Sweden.
I see. That's interesting. Didn't know that. Didn't know a lot. Okay, let's get back to living in Pittsburgh. Now you're in Squirrel Hill. You have three children.
Yes.
Where'd they go to school?
They went initially, they went to, by the time we moved into Squirrel Hill, Bruce was in the sixth grade, Eric would have been in about the third grade, Beth in the second grade, and they went to Whiteman School. And they continued through the Pittsburgh public schools until the 10th grade. In the 10th grade, we sent Bruce to Shadyside. Eric continued through Alderdice. Beth also went to Alderdice for a year, and then we sent her to Winchester.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about your family life, your cultural life in Pittsburgh, in Squirrel Hill, or in Pittsburgh.
We regularly go to the symphony. My wife is a member of the board of directors of the dance council, so we go to the modern dance programs, and we're involved to some extent in the activities of the dance council. Those are the principal cultural activities.
And how about the children? What would, did they, well, that's a dumb question. Let's go on with the children. Where did they go after high school?
Bruce went from Shadyside to Antioch, which out here in Ohio was a work-study program. He had, it's amazing to think about now because he's so different, but at the time he had difficulty concentrating. So he would work very hard for a few months and then not at all for the next few months throughout school. And so we thought that was a good idea, and he became, I think, independently interested in going to Antioch for reasons probably of his own. So he went to Antioch in a five-year program, took a year off in the middle, so it was a six-year program, and did work study. And that was very useful to him. I think he learned a lot in the work study program. One of the things that youngsters generally, and certainly I've noticed it in my children, is that when you go to school, you don't have a very good idea of you're preparing to do whatever job it is. I mean, you want to be a chemist or something. But you have no idea about what it's like to work at that job 40 or 60 hours a week. And I think the work-study program for Bruce was very good because it divested him of some notions about what he didn't want to do and focused him a little bit. But he had always, I think, had a hankering as a child to be an MD. And he had gone to, he had worked at the hospital as a volunteer when he was young, and he had gone to a course in anatomy when he was still in high school as an overload from his thing at Shadyside. So he had had some interest in that, and I remember he took Gray's Anatomy out of the library, and I had a deuce of a time out of the Carnegie Mellon Library, and I had a deuce of a time getting it back from him to return it after somebody else wanted it. I think he'd had it for about 18 months.
Oh, my word.
So he'd always had an interest in that sort of thing. And eventually, he worked for quite a while after he got his bachelor's degree, worked at various labs doing research, biological, chemical research, and then he went to medical school at Tufts. Yes, and he's now he's done his a postdoc in Providence, and he's now a professor, an assistant professor at the medical school at Tufts in pediatrics and psychiatry. And I'm very pleased to say he just told me the day before yesterday that it was his first year and he was voted by the graduating class the best teacher that they had in their experience.
Wow, that's a feather in the cap. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And he's the one who is an observant Jew,
I believe. He's the one that's an observant Jew.
Right, yeah. Okay, we talked about that.
Yes.
Okay, now tell us about the secondary or the college education of number two.
Number two. He went to the University of Rochester. He majored in political science. They have a very good political science department. They were the heavily mathematical, game theoretic, modern approach and so on. And that was a good major. And he finished that. He went 4 years, I mean, sort of did things. Then he took a year off. He had learned a lot of Russian here at Alderdice, and then took more Russian when he was at Rochester. And we had sent him to Russia for a year for summer.
Now, what year was that?
What year was that? Be about 70... summer 79. I'll never forget him going off to Russia, I mean, with his blue jeans with a hole in the back, carrying his duffel bag over his shoulder or going down to take the bus because he was going to meet his sister or something for lunch. Didn't want to have anything to do with taking him to the airport or anything. He was going to do all that by himself. And off he went. And we then, my wife and I, went to Brazil for the summer. I was working in Brazil every summer for about 4 years, teaching a little bit, advising the Brazilian Central Bank. Anyway, he went off to Russia, and at Christmas time, we came back to our great surprise. He had brought back all kinds of Russian antiques. I mean, an onyx desk set and a samovar and all of these things, which he had partly smuggled out of Russia because we weren't allowed to take a lot of these things out because they were pre-revolutionary. The desk set was pre-revolutionary. Beautiful desk set, which I still have on my desk at home.
Was he working there?
He went to a program, I think, run, if I remember, by the University of Michigan. And the idea was to improve his Russian. He went to school there and took some classes and got to see Moscow and Leningrad and so on. And the next...